Welcome to another edition of the Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, August 11th, 2023. Of course, the website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other programs I participate in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, a contact page, and many other useful and important links. I am on Twitter and Gab at Realist Report, and you can find me on Telegram at t.me/TheRealistReport. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to and help edit The Barnes Review, a bi-monthly revisionist magazine. Please do subscribe to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all of the details. All right, today I'm joined once again by Dr. Kevin McDonald. All right, Dr. Kevin McDonald, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
Great to be here.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say that. Thank you very much for joining me once again. You've been a guest on this program a number of times over the years. It's been a while since we've last done a podcast, so thanks a lot for taking the time. Yeah, there's a lot of topics that we could discuss, and it's always quite an honor and a privilege to speak with you. You are, of course, the editor of the Occidental Observer, and that website is theoccidentalobserver.net, and you are also the editor of the print and digital publication called The Occidental Quarterly, which is billed as a journal of Western perspectives on man, culture, and politics. It's a very scholarly and thorough publication. I'll have a link over to both your the Occidental Observer website, which I follow via email, and I get an email update with all the articles that go up there, and then also a link over to the Occidental Quarterly for anybody interested in checking that publication out and potentially subscribing. It is, as I said, a very excellent, very scholarly publication, so I'd encourage everybody to check both the websites out. I've been following the Occidental Observer for years, so there's always great material posted there. And I know a lot of times your articles are also syndicated on the UNS Review. Yeah. So that's another way to kind of follow what you're doing. I had been following you on Twitter for a long time as well. And I know you and our friend James Edwards, Paul Fromm, Tom Sunek, I believe, everybody kind of got banned all at once a couple months ago. And this was, of course, after Elon Musk, this so-called free speech absolutist, or that's the way he was presented in the media, took over Twitter and promised to restore free speech on the platform. I'm frankly, you know, surprised that I even am able to maintain a Twitter profile. I'm not verified. I'm basically shadow banned. It's almost impossible to see anything I'm tweeting unless you go directly to my Twitter page. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's up with it. I mean, I had my website, like the website, therealistreport.com, was banned on Twitter for a very, very long time. Like, you could not post a link to my website. It would automatically flag it as like a malicious website that would like hack your information or whatever. So, you know, you really couldn't share anything from my website on Twitter. That has changed. I can post links now, or at least I have been able to recently. But I don't really have a whole lot of faith or trust in any of these big social media platforms. It's almost sort of not even worth bothering with them anymore. I mean, Twitter is still useful, I find, but, you know, it's not something where, you know, I'm going to be able to reach a lot of people. They did sort of, they did something right around the time when all that drama was going on with Kanye West. They sort of like loosened up the restrictions or something, because all of a sudden the tweets that I was sending out were getting like 20,000, 30,000 views. Mm-hmm. And that quickly changed. I mean, after that, you know, I was able to tweet like that for a couple of days, and you know, of course, I was tweeting some very controversial, you know, making some controversial statements on Twitter about what Kanye West was saying, about the reality and nature of Jewish power and influence in the country, and yeah, it was getting a lot of traction, a lot of likes, a lot of retweets, a lot of commentary, a lot of views, and that quickly got shut down, and I was forced to delete all those tweets in order to maintain my account. So I know you've been banned, and it doesn't sound like you're going to be getting your Twitter profile back anytime soon. So, again, just another reflection on the state of quote-unquote free speech in America today. It's absolutely a dead concept anymore, it seems like.
Well, it's odd because I saw this quote from Jonathan Greenblatt, the ADL guy, saying that they've still been involved with Twitter before Musk and after Musk. And yet, if you read Jewish sites, they hate Musk. They think he's an anti-Semite. And Musk has been going after the ADL because, you know, that South African thing where they're singing Kill the Boer, you know, and Musk is saying that this looks like an invitation to genocide. And why doesn't the ADL comment on that? And so they didn't comment. Finally, they said today, sort of reluctantly, you know, with a lot of hemming and hawing. But they did say that you could possibly interpret it that way.
Right.
But,
yeah, I've got actually the quote directly from Jonathan Greenblatt. I just came across this article today. It was published in the Jewish Telegraph Agency.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and Greenblatt said, "While it is a historic protest song," he's referring to the song that Musk was pointing out. So he says, "While it is a historic protest song that called for the dismantlement of the racist apartheid system in South Africa, its crude lyrics could be interpreted as a call for violence." So a very sort of wishy-washy.
Very wishy-washy.
Way. Yeah, exactly. An interesting development, though. I mean, that's the thing with a guy like Musk and Trump. Even we'll get into Trump here as we proceed. They sort of, I mean, sort of like a wild card type player. I mean, I think Musk, just like Trump, I think they both have a lot of potential to make some major changes. But I've frankly been disappointed in both of them. And you know, the fact that you guys are all basically banned from Twitter. I mean, they wouldn't even let Nick Fuentes back on Twitter, Andrew Anglin. I mean, everybody is pretty much
Jared
been banned. Jared Taylor. Yeah, Jared Taylor's been banned for years now.
Yeah.
And
he was one of the
first people to get
banned.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I guess some of his material is sort of controversial, but it's very fact-based. It's nothing bombastic or
it's very
scholarly.
Very,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And yet he's been banned for a very long time. Probably one of the original people to get banned. And I know he fought a lawsuit against Twitter that I don't think really went anywhere, unfortunately, just given the corrupt nature of the quote unquote justice system in this country. But yeah, it's an interesting development. And like I said, Musk, it's clear he has a lot of potential. He seems to have somewhat good convictions on certain issues, but at the end of the day, you know, he continues to let the ADL basically call the shots on Twitter, at least when it comes to allowing dissident voices like yours or Jared Taylor on the platform. So
yeah, for sure.
So anyways, speaking of the ADL, there's three main topics I want to kind of focus on in this podcast today. And the first one, of course, deals with the ADL. There was a recent initiative that they launched to organize this. It's called the J7. We hear about the G7, which is like the network of seven, you know, of the leading economic countries in the world. And this is sort of modeled off of that, apparently. It's called the J7. It's this international coalition of Jewish groups working together to combat anti-Semitism and otherwise coordinating to advance Jewish political interests. Now, it's amazing because – and this is a story that I wrote about on my website, therealistreport.com. It's sort of amazing because, you know, it's often decried by organizations like the Anti-Defamation League, like its CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, like other Jewish leaders, that it's this like irrational, hateful, completely asinine, totally delusional conspiracy theory to recognize the fact that Jews do, in fact, coordinate both within certain countries like the United States and also internationally to advance their own unique political and economic goals and just wield their influence in various ways that manipulate and pressure governments, private sector actors, you know, mass media corporations, the educational establishment to, you know, quote-unquote combat anti-Semitism, which essentially amounts to people speaking or writing openly and critically about the reality of Jewish power and influence in the world, and of course to promote the Holocaust and things like this. You know, they would denounce these things as like an irrational, delusional conspiracy theory. And yet here's an article again from the Jewish Telegraph Agency. The headline is ADL and major Jewish groups in seven countries team up to fight anti-Semitism together. And I'll just read briefly from the article. It says here, large Jewish organizations in seven countries outside of Israel have formed a task force to collaborate on fighting anti-Semitism. The task force, nicknamed the J7 and announced Tuesday, includes representatives from the United States, France, the United Kingdom, Germany, Canada, Argentina, and Australia. According to multiple recent estimates, those countries have the largest populations of Jews outside of Israel, excluding Russia, which was not included in the task force. Israel will also not have an official representative on the task force, though many, if not all, of the leading participating groups see combating anti-Zionism as part of their mandate. And the article goes on to quote Jonathan Greenblatt talking about how anti-Semitism is rising around the world, and it's this huge threat to democracy and to open societies. And then I just wanted to read one more section from the article. It says here, the task force is not the first time Jewish organizations and activists have coordinated across borders. Several groups, including the World Jewish Congress, the World Zionist Organization, and the Jewish Agency for Israel, have offices and staff in countries around the world promoting connections to Israel, Jewish education, advocacy against anti-Semitism and other causes, and Jewish groups have been coming together across borders to fight anti-Semitism for at least two decades. So isn't it sort of amazing what you can read in explicitly Jewish publications, and yet, you know, if you were to openly comment on this or point it out, again, it would be like this hateful conspiracy theory you're promoting. There, you know, according to the ADL, for example, it's just absolutely astonishing. I'm curious. I don't know if you saw this or if you have any comments on it.
Well,
but
yeah, one thing that really strikes me is two decades. Are you kidding me? It goes back to the 19th century at least. That, in fact, Jews have always had this sort of international outlook. I mean, in the Middle Ages, Jewish communities would communicate with each other and have dealings with each other. But in the 19th century, you had these Jewish organizations that actively promoted Jewish interests around the world, and sometimes against the interests of the country they were living in. Like in France, it was a famous scandal where they opposed French policy in what is now Syria, and it was very much against French policy, but they did it anyway. And that's the thing now, you know, that this Zionist push is clearly, you know, does anybody really think that the interests of Israel are the same as the interests of all those seven countries that have signed on to this? Of course not. I mean, you promoting the interests of a country that is extremely warlike and is very controversial, actually. And, it really has its own set of interests. Yet, of course, within this country and elsewhere, they always say that there are no conflicts of interest between what the United States wants and what the Zionists want. But, you know, we know that we've had these wars in the Middle East all about the Israel lobby. And there are huge conflicts of interest.
That's true. And I mean, that is the way it's always presented. You know, you look at like Jonathan Greenblatt or any of these other major Jewish figures, Jewish leaders, the way they present their case is it's as if it's this benevolent cause, you know, designed to, you know, advance American democracy and protect and strengthen American democracy and things like this. When clearly they have their own unique set of interests that they're advancing, and it's sort of just masqueraded and through the use of propaganda in the media, it's sort of, you know, presented in a much different light, as if it's designed to benefit everybody, to benefit America. And I mean, if you look at like the key issues that are championed and spearheaded by the organized Jewish community from a historical or even a contemporary perspective, whether we're talking about, you know, the concept of mass immigration and what it means to even be an American, the concept of our national identity, or for, you know, a more modern example, like the support for this whole LGBTQ+ madness, or, you know, further mass immigration with refugees and stuff like this, diversity, multiculturalism, even issues like gun control. You know, Jews are some of the leading proponents of, you know, gun control and stripping stripping away our Second Amendment right. And it's clear that their agenda, that their advancement of these sorts of issues is often, almost always, to the detriment of average Americans. It's not in our interests. And certainly these wars, our foreign policy for the past 20 years at least, I mean, even before that, but certainly since, you know, the global war on terrorism and you know, the events of 9/11, certainly what we see in the Ukraine, none of this benefits America. In fact, it harms our interests.
No.
So.
Absolutely. Yeah, they really can't conceive, or at least they'll never say that they're conflicts of interest. But it's obvious to anybody. Certainly, Mearsheimer and Wald—that was a major point that they had. But in their book, The Israel Lobby. But
right.
The Israel Lobby is about advocacy. They're not about truth, and so you have to always. And that, you know, that's one thing I enjoyed being on Twitter, because I followed the ADL and I would often comment on their ridiculous tweets. And that was one of the things I miss, really, that I'm not able to, a lot of times I can't even see Twitter. I can't even look at it. They just say, you know, you can't do that. You know, and other times I can see, but I can't comment or anything.
Right. Well, and it's
I was really taking Twitter seriously. I built up when Musk took over, my Twitter followers started going up, you know, steadily. And from about, you know, 50% or so, and in a short period of time, and all of a sudden, you're suspended. So, I really was unhappy about that, because I was seeing that as a major source of influence. But then, you know, now I'm on Gab. I got like 2,700 followers. I get very few likes or anything. Before, I had like 44,000 or 46,000 or something on Twitter. And, you know, right. I was shadow banned for years. I mean, I for years, until Musk took over, I was totally shadow banned. I stayed right where I was, about 30,000 or so, and never went up, never went down, just stayed there. And I know my tweets got very few looks or anything. So that's the way it was. And now I'm completely put off from it.
Yeah, exactly. It's the state of America and, you know, especially with the ADL dictating, you know, social media policy to most of these big platforms. It's absolutely incredible. Well, and that goes to the heart of the purpose of this very group, this international, you know, Jewish task force to combat anti-Semitism, the J7, as they call it. I mean, it's basically focused on coordinating these international Jewish groups across the world to pressure governments and social media outlets to stifle any open and honest discussion of the role that Jews play in our society. And that's what they consider anti-Semitism.
The fact is that Jews are the most organized people in the world. I mean, there's just hundreds of Jewish organizations. Even in this country, there's probably at least 100 big organizations. And they have the coordinating committee where you have the presidents of the major Jewish organizations and that sort of thing. And so it's extremely well organized.
And well financed. These people are making millions of dollars doing this. Yeah.
Yeah. I think back in the 1990s, they said their budget of Jewish organizations was $6 billion a year. That was in the 90s. Who knows what it is now? But this is what Jewish wealth is all about, ultimately. It goes to Jewish causes, or a significant part of it, or most of it, probably. And it goes to Jewish education and Jewish attempts to get Jews to marry other Jews. It goes, of course, Israel lobbying and the Holocaust and the whole thing. So it's pervasive and it's intense. And one thing they do is to organize other groups in the multicultural West, you know, like in America, they're organizing with the blacks and the Hispanics and the Asians and everybody else. I'm just reading Frank Salter's new book. He's co-authored it with a guy named Harry Richardson about Australia. And it's the same thing there. They organize these other groups when there's a lawsuit related to diversity or immigration, Jewish lawyers, Jewish judges, and the whole thing. The Jewish organizations are actively making ties with the Muslims that are coming in from the Middle East, blacks with Africa. You know, they all of them. And so they are sort of the king organizing group of all this multicultural stuff. And I think that's true basically around the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In the Western world, anyway. Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure you know this, but their role in the whole, you know, like refugee resettlement sort of racket is astonishing. I mean, these people are getting money directly from national governments in many cases, maybe even from the UN and some international organizations, to work to actively bring largely, you know, uneducated, very low skill migrants from the Middle East, from Africa, from basically the global South, and working to resettle them into the West. And they're often making a decent profit doing this. It's like they're financially incentivized to sort of, you know, replace Westerners in their own countries. And that actually leads into another article that I wanted to bring to your attention. I'm sure you saw this. And again, this idea of like the Great Replacement has been hysterically denounced as a lunatic, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. I mean, the ADL organized this big campaign to get Tucker Carlson fired from Fox News for openly talking about the concept of the Great Replacement on his show when he was on Fox News. Chuck Schumer has gone on these, you know, hysterical rants, you know, in the halls of Congress about people talking about the Great Replacement and how it's some, you know, crazy conspiracy theory. And yet here's an article published by The Hill, one of the leading, more establishment political newspapers in this country. The headline here is, America's white majority is aging out, seemingly confirming the very concept of the Great Replacement. Let me just I'll just read briefly from the article and then you can comment. It says here, Generation Z will be the last generation of Americans with a white majority, according to census data. The nation's so-called majority-minority arrived with Generation Alpha, those born since about 2010. Barely two decades from now, around 2045, non-Hispanic white people will fall below half as a share of the overall U.S. population. Those conclusions and the numbers behind them seem simple enough, yet some scholars contend that the numbers are wrong or at least misleading, and that the looming ascent of a majority-minority America is a myth. America's white majority and its numbered days is a lightning rod topic given the nation's history of slavery and enduring patterns of discrimination against minorities and immigrants. You gotta love that. Don't you dare be upset with the fact that you're being replaced systematically by government policy. You know, could you imagine? I mean, again, you apply this to any other non-white country, you know, would we be celebrating the displacement of Africans in Africa or whatever the case is? This only applies to the West due to this totally weaponized narrative promoted by the mass media, promoted by Jewish activists and other liberal, you know, more communist leaning academics. It's absolutely incredible. And you know, again, here's a very influential mainstream publication openly reporting this.
Yeah. And of course, the ADL has said it's anti-Semitic and racist and everything else to say that. At the same time, they have, you know, supported Israel in its policy of immigration, which restricts it to Jews. And this Great Replacement is a reality. Of course, you know, something like a Hill will not say that the whole point of immigration from... If you look at Jewish activism from, you know, at least 1920 up through the 1965 Immigration Act, it was all about bringing in other cultures in order to make it safer for Jews. And of course, when immigration happens of all these other people, you know, it's obvious that the political and cultural power of the white majority is going to go down. But you act like, oh, that's just racist and everything to say that. Of course, and as you say, every other country in the world, you know, has immigration policies that want to maintain the people that are native to it and built it. The Japanese just enacted stronger immigration policies. Nobody blinks an eye here. But if somebody talks about immigration restriction here or deporting all these people, that is really the whole thing's illegitimate. And now, and with Mayorkas and the Biden administration, they're just massive, probably 5-6 million people in the last 2.5 years. So it's an invasion. And they know that in these Jewish organizations love it. They will actively be organizing these people. They'll try to get them to be able to vote as soon as possible. And they will assume that that the white majority, traditional white majority of this country is gone. It's going to be gone. And I, you know, when that happens, I'm very afraid because, you know, you think about what happened in the Soviet Union and when the Bolsheviks came into power. You had a dominant Jewish elite that participated in mass murders. That look the other way in this country and everything else. And we have to anticipate that when whites become a minority, they will become a vulnerable and hated minority. What
right.
we see
well, we
is
basically
increasing,
already are.
We already are. Well, we're still a majority, but we're a hated majority. And we see, you know, expressions of hatred toward white people more and more often in the mainstream media. And nobody calls about it. You know, there's all over Twitter, anti-white hate, for example. No one cares about that. The ADL doesn't care about that. But, yeah, I mean, it's pervasive, and it's not going to get any better. It's getting worse. I'm just reading this book by Frank Salter and his co-author talking about that in Australia and making the point. It keeps getting worse. The more the demographics change and the more you have this, you know, entrenched multicultural political establishment where they're enacting affirmative action and quotas and all that, the more you have this, and this is government funded, the more you're going to see anti-white hate and the more you have seen it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Absolutely. Well, and it's also amazing how, you know, on the one hand, people like Chuck Schumer, Jonathan Greenblatt, and pretty much every other, you know, major political figure and media talking head will denounce this whole concept of the great replacement. And yeah. yet on the other hand, they'll actually celebrate it when, you know, actually presenting the idea of an increasingly non-white America, a more diverse, less white America that's celebrated and elevated and actually presented as a good thing and presented as a necessary and justified development in American society. Here's actually, this is, and then this kind of goes to the heart of it. I mean, you can see the videos that, you know, the video, you know, collections that people have put together on social media and, you know, YouTube and stuff like that of all the politicians openly celebrating and embracing, you know, the great replacement, including the president himself. But this is, and again, this is a very mainstream opinion. This is the way it's presented in The Hill, for example, in the same article. It's just sort of towards the end of the article. It says here, demographers say that America will need a diverse population if it is to prosper in the decades to come. It talks about how the nation's median age is almost 39, the highest that it's ever been. For America's economic growth to persist, demographers say, the nation needs a steady stream of immigrants. New arrivals, especially from Latin America, keep the nation young. The median age for non-Hispanic white people is 43, according to census data. For Hispanic people, it is 31. Immigration is a good thing for America, said Frey, the Brookings researcher. This was a study, by the way, organized by the Brookings Institute. You're going to want a country that's growing and robust and has a lot of energy and people who will contribute to Social Security and Medicare. And you just can't count. And you just can't count on whites for that. Now, I don't have all the statistics in front of me, but correct me if I'm wrong. Aren't whites like overwhelmingly the majority of, you know, taxpayer, you know, the revenue that's generated by taxes? A lot of these people coming into the country are on, you know, welfare, or they're not even, you know, paying into the system. They're paid off the books. And also it's never really addressed. Like, why don't we have policies that encourage people to get married and have kids and raise healthy families. I mean, the way this is all presented is just so one-sided and just anti-white. I mean, it's designed to prevent us from even having that conversation.
Yeah. And you know, now the educational system is definitely trying to indoctrinate children and I think really directed at white children to, you know, think about being gender fluid or transgender or all those things, which are very disaster for fertility. But as you say, I mean, countries like Hungary have encouraged fertility, and you can do that. And we have a real anti-family thing that's been going on for decades. And it's not surprising that white people, and especially white women, an awful lot of white, young white women, they're just not, they want careers and all that. They don't want children particularly. They're on the left. They love immigration and the whole thing. We've got a huge, huge problem here. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how to deal with it.
Well, and it's amazing because, I mean, you can find the stats, and I should have done that before we started. I mean, whites are for sure, on average, a net positive to society when it comes to contributing resources and taxes and stuff like that. All these other groups, especially the immigrants that have very few skills, most of them, especially the ones that are coming over here illegally, which is a huge percentage of them, they have very few resources, very little education, very little capital. They're not able to perform, dynamic, productive work in a very advanced technological society. So how again are these people going to make this country prosper and, continue to live up to the civilizational standards that we've built over the course of the past 300 years or whatever it is? It's just it's just an asinine concept. You bring the third world to your country, you're going to eventually have a third world country. And you see that in many major cities today. I mean, you go to like Los Angeles or some of these other big cities and you look at some of these neighborhoods and it looks like you could be in Mexico or any other third world country. It's incredible.
We got a situation where at least 40%, I think almost 50% of the people in America don't pay taxes because they go below, their income's not enough. Well, the people they're bringing in are certainly going to be in that category. And they're uneducated and they're coming from low IQ populations. They're never going to. They act as if all peoples are interchangeable. You could populate America with all black Africans or something like that, and they'll just be scientists and engineers and doctors and lawyers, and they'll just recreate America. All you have to do is have certain beliefs, certain principles, and you'll just have the same country. And it won't happen that way. There's just too much of a genetic input here. And the whole point of bringing these people in, as many people have said, is to combat white power and cultural and political power. And that's exactly what is happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, really, these two stories I wanted to bring up just to sort of demonstrate the way the media and some of these, high profile activist groups like the ADL and our political class just engage in the most extreme form of gaslighting and psychological manipulation, where they will, you will be hysterically denounced as a racist, a white supremacist, a conspiracy theorist, an anti-Semite for recognizing the reality of what's going on in this world and who's doing what and who's advancing, what sort of agenda, whether it's the ADL forming this international, Jewish coalition to combat anti-Semitism, or the fact that the Great Replacement is openly reported and documented by leading academic institutions like the Brookings Institute. And yet at the same time, it'll be denounced as some dangerous conspiracy theory that leads to violence. Right. It's the level of psychological manipulation on display is so insulting and outrageous that
you have to have two digit 70 IQ not to get it. That this is propaganda. It's a complete lie. And it's like.
But they continue to double down and run with these asinine narratives and just expect you to shut up and go along with it, lest you be called a racist.
They've got the power, they got the media power, they got the educational systems completely taken over, all the government institutions like the FBI, it's all arrayed against us right now. And, that's why I say I'm pretty pessimistic. How do we get out of here? How do we get out of this situation? I don't get it. I don't see a way out. But you got trillions of dollars arrayed against us between the federal government and all these NGOs and wealth arrayed against us. It's just
We're in a tough spot. There's no doubt about that.
A very tough spot. Yeah. I don't see how to get out of it.
Frankly, well, and that really kind of. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I don't see how you go ahead. If you have some ideas on how to get out of it, I'm all ears because I'm despairing really that this is too much. I'm hoping that they could have small enclaves at least for a while. I mean, I'm living in an area where they're pretty simpatico with me, but at the same time, that the country's just brutally being taken over, I don't see how we vote our way out of this. I really don't.
Right. Oh, yeah. I agree with that. Well, it is quite a daunting challenge when you look at it objectively. And you're right. There's no easy answers. There's no easy solution. And that kind of leads into the final topic I wanted to talk about, and that's like the current state of American politics and the Biden administration's war on not only Donald Trump, but also white America in general, conservatives in general, make America great again type people in general. And that's been going on since the moment he stepped foot in the White House.
Yeah.
And of course, the whole January 6th, quote unquote, insurrection, which is increasingly every single day being revealed to be just a total setup from start to finish. I mean, there's all sorts of federal informants involved.
Yeah.
And of course, the way the coverage that the media provided, I mean, it was basically a spectacle set up that the media could use to run with this quote unquote insurrection narrative. It's just absolutely incredible. Now, Trump has been indicted three separate times now. This is unprecedented in American history. There's a looming fourth indictment, which is apparently expected any day now. I don't think it's been officially announced, but he has been indicted on three separate occasions in New York, in Florida, and then in Washington, D.C. The first one was dealing with alleged financial impropriety relating to the payment of Stormy Daniels, I believe. The one in Florida was about the classified document situation, and then this most recent one is for his role in the whole January 6th situation and really openly questioning the results of the 2020 election, which I don't know about you, but I have very, very serious doubts and skepticism about the official results of the 2020 election, and there's millions of people across the country that feel the same way. I mean, the idea that Joe Biden got nearly 82 million votes is absurd on the face of it. So basically this latest indictment is essentially, from my reading, I don't know if you follow Jonathan Turley, who's like this very mainstream constitutional, First Amendment type scholar. He's on CNN and a lot of the other big networks and, writes for a number of different publications. So he's like this very mainstream guy, but he's got a lot of really good analysis and a lot of really good takes on what's going on. And I think he's a pretty fair and objective legal observer anyways. I've been following his coverage of some of these indictments. The only one that seems to have any sort of legitimacy is the one in Florida dealing with the classified documents. I don't know all the details. I'm not a legal scholar. I'm not a lawyer. I basically view this war on Trump as an extension of the whole Russiagate situation. I mean, they've been trying to derail this man's political ambitions from day one, from the moment he stepped foot on the political stage. So yeah. I'm curious, what do you make of these indictments? I mean, I don't know how much of the details you know. There's a lot of information to get into with it, but I'm just curious, like, what do you make of the indictments? Do any of them have legal merit, or are they just designed to tie him up legally? It's like a lawfare campaign, basically, to tie him up legally and basically derail his political ambitions.
The hatred against Donald Trump by the establishment, by our elites, is unparalleled in American history, and they will try. I don't think Trump can be elected again, simply because they won't allow it. I mean, once again, there'll be some kind of massive fraud, and they'll condemn anyone who suggests that there could possibly have been any fraud as, a conspiracy nut. And this is incredible. I think Jonathan Turley is great. I was just reading his column today about the most recent one. And that one, you know, it's pretty clearly that they have to establish that Trump knew or felt, really strongly felt, that the election was fair. And I don't think he did. And there's a lot of reason to think that there was fraud going on.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, their basic argument is that he had advisors and people close to him telling him that the election was legitimate. Therefore, he knew, you know, what are you saying was lying. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The whole entire indictment is ridiculous.
Yeah, well, like, you have to believe some of the people that tell you that, but you can't believe other people.
Exactly.
Because other people were telling him, no, there's a legitimate reason here. And you know, you had this whole legal team that was saying that. And it's just... So that indictment is absolute crazy. But the other one with the classified documents, I don't know that much about it. I do think that he had a lot of power on that. I do think that they jumped the gun on that. They could have tried to negotiate more. They didn't have to go in there like that. And with the double standard, because now they got this, they're slow walking this Biden thing where he took all these boxes of documents, stored him in his various places, including his garage and his place at the University of Pennsylvania, which is funded by China. And now the Biden corruption thing. I mean, Jack Smith comes along with just a few weeks that he makes all these, two of these indictments, whereas the Hunter Biden thing was going on for years. They let, statute of limitations expire on his tax thing, and now there's more and more evidence that Biden was corrupt, that $20 million they're talking about now going to his family members. Are you saying that was for nothing? I don't think so.
Yeah.
And there's so much smoke there. It's ridiculous. But the FBI, I mean, the DOJ will never go after that. And they're going to have to they're still stonewalling on certain records, like bank records, that would really prove it. But
speaking of Jonathan Turley, his website is jonathanturley.org. And yeah. I highly encourage everybody to follow his blog, because he does a lot of really good reporting on this sort of thing. Anyways, he had a good article that just came out. I think it was today. It's called The Illusion of Scandal, How Washington is Attempting to Dismiss $20 Million as an Illusion.
Yeah.
And he goes through and basically lays out all the details of who was paying Biden, or not necessarily Biden himself directly, but, you know, Hunter and the family, the family trust and that sort of thing. I mean, this was brazen, shameless influence peddling corruption at the highest levels. And yet this has been covered up, dismissed, downplayed. Not even really reported for a long time. I mean, it's just outrageous, the double standards. And we've been seeing this for a long time. I mean, and Trump himself was even pointing this stuff out when he first, got involved in politics and was saying how he was going to investigate Hillary Clinton and he was going to lock her up. Yeah. And of course, that never happened. And the Democrat, that he absolutely should have. And
as hell.
Right. Yeah. They all are. The whole Democratic machine is just the most corrupt and most ruthless political corruption machine in modern history anyways. And yet, and these people, they want blood. They will stop at nothing to harm and lock up their political rivals. And we've seen that on display for years now. I mean, again, Trump talked a tough game when it came to Clinton, but didn't do anything, didn't prosecute her, didn't even really investigate her. And she's, of course, still operating on the political stage today. And, you know, we saw what happened with January 6th. All these people have been rounded up and just treated horrifically, subjected to the some of the worst legal abuses that we've seen, certainly against American citizens. It's just totally outrageous. Meanwhile, the BLM and Antifa people can do whatever they want. They can go out and insult people on camera. Andy Node was involved in a civil suit against a group of Antifa in Portland that on video cameras – violently assaulted him, attacked him, you know, were throwing water and projectiles and physically attacking this man. And they had it all on film. They had admissions from some of these people. And yet the judge still did not convict these people. So the double standards are not only at the highest levels of politics when it comes to Trump and how the whole entire justice system has been thrown at him. Not only the justice system, but also the Congress with these, impeachment trials that happened when he was in office, down to the street level, where BLM and Antifa can do whatever they want. They can burn down cities. They can attack people. They can attack Trump supporters. I mean, even before Trump came into office, you'd show up to a Trump rally in San Jose, California, for example, and you better be very, very prepared to defend yourself, because these people will attack you. Yeah.
That case in Portland was amazing. The defense attorney, when he's talking to the jury at the end, the final summation, is saying, we know who you are. And if you convict, the obvious intimidation, they were saying, if you convict, we will come after you. And the judge allowed that, never said a word about it. I mean, come on, that's just absolutely out of line to be able to do that. So, yeah, the justice system is completely corrupt, and you cannot trust it. I mean, you were talking earlier about Jared Taylor and Twitter, and you have all these airtight cases. James Edwards in the Detroit newspaper, they called him a Klan leader or something, which was ridiculous. And they acknowledged it was false, but they didn't say anything. But you have to be judged by the company you keep. And, he's had David Duke on his show and that sort of thing. So that's all it takes. It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is amazing. And these double standards and just, just the blatant weaponization of the rule of law is just so incredible and vividly on display.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to dismiss at this point.
It's frightening. And you got to realize that someone like you or I, if we got, indicted on something, we don't stand a chance in this system. They're going to go after us. They have a lot of money on their side with the government prosecuting, and they'll have judges on their side. It's just not going to work out. And so you got to dread getting indicted by the federal government at this point.
Yeah. Well, and I guess it's almost what's really kind of amazing to me is it's like we're really at like third world, like dictatorship levels.
We are.
When Biden himself, I mean, there's clips of Biden at press conferences and, being asked by basically responding to the media, responding to the press about how he will make sure that Trump doesn't get back in the White House. He's going to use the Department of Justice to go after Trump legally and to prevent him from getting back into the White House. Just the other day, I saw a headline from Russia Today. Here it is right here. No more U.S. if Trump regains presidency. This is Nancy Pelosi. And she was basically saying that they will – essentially she's saying that she will not – the Democrats, the media, the deep state, they will not let Trump back in the White House. If he were to be president, it would be a criminal enterprise in the White House. Again, you gotta love the inversion. I mean, I'm not trying to say that Trump was perfect or he wasn't corrupt in some ways, but a criminal enterprise in the White House, doesn't that precisely describe the Biden crime family and the Clinton crime family before them and all the shenanigans that Obama was into? It's amazing how just openly politicized the rule of law is. And just the way these things are even talked about these days, they're not even making an attempt to conceal their hatred and just outright contempt for Trump. They're going after him. And again, this is something that's been going on for a long time. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, what does it say about Trump and maybe what he represents or the potential that he has that the media and the political establishment and the deep state continue to use every dirty trick in the book against him?
Yeah. Well, I think it's what he said during his campaign in 2016. I mean, these things never came to pass, but he was against immigration. He was against legal and illegal immigration. He was talking about how Europe had been destroyed. Brussels isn't Brussels anymore. Paris isn't Paris anymore. And he was openly coming out in that direction. To that, to Jewish activists, that was fascism. And you had to immediately come down on it. So, I mean, I wrote like five articles for Vida back in 2016 about, the hatred directed against Trump at that time, where they were calling him Hitler and everything else. And it didn't stop. We don't. There are two impeachments. This Russia scandal. Russia, 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 which was ridiculous. And, you know, the other thing, of course, what that really got, especially the neocons, was he was talking about being even-handed around the world, that, you know, withdrawing from the Middle East, that sort of thing, not being so aggressive with foreign policy, and not, you know, getting into one war after another. Boy, did they hate that. And, I mean, just this year, when DeSantis said something similar, agreed with that, you know, basically, they went crazy, the neocons did. So, yeah, those are the two issues, I think. That, you know, diversity issues related to immigration, the wall, all that, and the idea of, you know, a non-interventionist foreign policy.
Yeah, just the very concept of America First is like totally, you know, contrary to the neocons and the deep state running Washington, D.C. and controlling the mass media. It's almost like this, you know, it's like blasphemy to these people. I mean, the very idea of putting America first and doing what's best for our country, doing what's best for our workers, our people, and making America great again. I mean, that's the last thing that these people want to see. They want to destroy America.
Yeah, they'll go back and find Hitler said something like that, and they'll be in the, you know, all over. And in fact, they did do exactly that.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious. I mean, what do you? I'd like to get your take on this potential second term for Trump. I mean, I think you know, if we saw some of the shenanigans that happened in the last election, I have very little faith and trust in the integrity of elections, and I have for a long time. But the 2020 election was just so brazen and just not even plausible in my mind. It wasn't even. There's no way in hell that Biden got 82 million legitimate votes.
No.
It's just asinine. So I'm curious, like, just your assessment. I know this is sort of, you know, we're trying to predict the future, but do you think that he does have a potential second term, and how do you think it would be different, maybe?
Well, as I said before, I don't think that they will allow that. That it's just way too, you know, the hatred is so intense that you can't even imagine it, and they will not allow that to happen. Having said that, I think that the other idea is that they sort of want, a lot of Democrats want Trump to be nominated because they think they can beat him. And so that when they read stuff that these various indictments are actually increasing Trump's support, they, you know, say, good, you know, he'll be nominated. We can beat him. But they will not let him be president. I just don't think so. They'll pull in all the stops and they'll blatantly cheat and say you're a nutcase if you say that, as they did last time. And that's just
right. Well,
it's very depressing.
They're really sort of playing with fire at this point. I mean, we already saw the outrage, you know, and people taking to the streets on January 6th, and even leading up to that. I mean, there's some people that say – I actually interviewed a lady that was there relatively recently for American Free Press, a lady named Barbara Jansen. She went down there from I think it was a group in Massachusetts that they drove down there just for the day, you know, went to the rally and then went back. She didn't go in the Capitol or anything, but, I mean, she was saying – she was estimating nearly a million people in the nation's capital that day, and I've heard other people – say the same thing. And Trump to this day still maintains a huge amount of support with, you know, average, you know, traditional Americans, and of all races, frankly, but particularly white Americans, of course. And I think you're probably right. They are going to continue to use every dirty trick to prevent him from retaking the White House. Although at this point, nothing would surprise me in American politics anymore. Who knows? Maybe they somehow miraculously he will get back in the White House. I wanted to ask you just a couple other questions here, and then we'll wrap up. I know you've been republishing Ann Coulter on the OccidentalObserver.net, and I follow her Substack, and she's been very critical of Trump for a long time.
Oh, for a long time.
Yeah, she does make a lot of good points about Trump. Don't get me wrong, but she's very she seems to be very jaded with any sort of, and she's just totally you know, given up on Trump, it sounds like. And again, she has, you know, she has felt like that for a long time based on her writings. And she's sort of siding with DeSantis at this point. I frankly am so uninspired by DeSantis or really any of these other people that Ramaswamy, I mean, I guess he'll make some good points, but there's no way I could vote for somebody like that. The only person that I could support or vote for would be a Donald Trump. And I mean, again, he's not perfect. He's got a lot of flaws. He made a ton of mistakes his first term. You know, what is he doing appointing some of these people to his administration? Who is he listening? Why is he listening to these people? Yeah. So who knows? Maybe he's learned some lessons. I think he still does make a lot of mistakes. I think he continues to double down on the vaccine and the COVID nonsense. And, you know, most people have seen through that at this point. So it's I don't know. It's sort of a mixed bag. I think my general take is that anything that's sort of bringing these issues to the attention of people and sort of letting average people know the stakes involved and just what the Democrats are up to. I mean, these people want to totally destroy the country. And sadly, there's a lot of Republicans that work with them, basically, like, you know, these rhino Republicans that go along with it. And that's pretty much most of the Republicans in Congress, frankly. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It is a tough situation, as you said. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. I'm hoping and praying that, you know, there's not some huge violent incident or something even potentially staged by the government or media itself to provoke something like that. But I could see it getting the tensions in this country continue to simmer and boil over. Yeah. And we're you know, it's a sort of a dangerous situation at this point, I think.
Yeah, we were talking about, in the media, even 5-6 years ago, people were talking about hyperpolarization. And it's just gotten more intense now. And I think a Trump presidency, the good thing about it is we need polarization. We have to have it out. I mean, I always said that you know, 2016, you had Jeb Bush running. He was the odds on it. All the money went to Jeb Bush. It would have been Hillary against Jeb Bush. Well, who cares who's president at that point? And so what I'm saying is there wouldn't have been any conflict, but Trump became president. And that was the best thing because it really woke up the real divisions in our country because of what he said and what he was emphasizing. We need that. We need hyperpolarization because we can't just go on with middle of the road Republicans and radical Democrats sort of hand in hand, Republicans sort of criticizing these Democrats, the radicals a little bit, but sort of, you know, going along with most of it. I agree. Trump is problematic. You know, I just don't know that he does, if his second term would be any better. Would he not appoint someone like Christopher Wray? Horrible appointment. And so many like that.
John Bolton, Nikki Haley. I mean, he was appointing people that were openly hostile to what he was trying to do.
Yeah, and you hear,
yeah, well, exactly. The entrenched deep state was already hostile to him, and you know, you hear people sort of make excuses for it or try to explain it, and I mean, I get it to a certain extent, but at the end of the day, the buck stops with him. I mean, you know, here's this big time businessman. I mean, you know, very, very savvy political operator, at least according to his supporters. You know, somebody that seems to really get it. He's a winner. He's won in the private sector. He's won in politics. And yet he just made one mistake after the other. Yeah. And, you know, it was sad to watch. I mean, again, going back to what, you know, I had said earlier about Elon Musk and even Donald Trump. I mean, these guys have a lot of potential to really change the conversation, to really change the game. And potentially still do to this day. It's just a matter of do they have the will? Do they have the balls to do it? I think, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's really bad out there.
Right, it is a tough spot. Also, one more sort of silver lining, I guess, that I'll bring up before we wrap up here is, it is a mess. What the state of America? It's a total disaster. We're seeing this American empire crumble before our very eyes, and the people who founded and built this once great republic being systematically displaced in a very real great replacement strategy pursued and promoted by the federal government itself and championed and celebrated by virtually every element of society, the media, academia, you know, these activist groups, you name it. So it is a very difficult situation, obviously. No one would deny that. However, there's a lot of positive things going on. There's a lot more, as you said, sort of polarization, a lot more people recognizing just what is going on in this country. And there's a lot more, you know, sort of pro-white groups forming and organizing and networking. And those are all, I think, very positive and necessary developments. So it's going to take a lot of hard work, but, you know, we got to keep talking about these issues and standing up for the truth and standing up for our people, frankly.
It's so hard for most white people to, you know, unless they're really clued in, you know, when they turn on the media, they don't get anything like what we're talking about. And so it's hard for them, but I think they understand there's something wrong and they're looking for something. Let's hope so. The other problem are a lot of young white people are just completely sleepwalking into a horrible, horrible future. I can't believe that because, you know, these are the people that stand the most to lose. Young people, young white men especially, are going to be completely frozen out. And they already are. And they are the ones that are suffering from this. It's a disaster for them. But they don't seem to really get it. Don't get me started.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Like I said, it's a tough spot we're in. And if anybody is interested in getting caught up and up to speed with what's going on, they got to check out theoccidentalobserver.net, your website, and, of course, the Occidental Quarterly as well. So, yeah. Dr. McDonald, it's been great talking to you once again. We'll definitely stay in touch and have to do this again, maybe somewhat more regularly. It's been a couple years since the last podcast we did, but it's always, like I said from the beginning, a very, you know, a pleasure and a huge honor to speak with you. You've had a huge influence on my thinking and continue to do so. So, thanks for all your great work over the years.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'll do it again.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks, sir.
Yeah.
Okay. Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye.